also unwisely said I'd chair my own meeting so often. Well, time to defer. Sorry. Sorry, yeah, my name is Adam Buick.
Adam, thanks, Adam. My name's John, I'm a member of the CPGB. Thanks for that introduction. I presume I don't get 20 minutes, unfortunately. No, I mean, seriously. So I think it's a good idea for you also to limit my things. So if you could time...
How long do you want?
Only it's entirely up to you. Exactly. I mean, just going to check that we don't then all end up.
You don't get my advice.
Anyway, okay, having done that, let me just make some of my points. Some of what you were saying, Adam, it did strike me as slightly reminiscent of the sort of Cold War sort of account of Bolshevism. It's not what I understand in terms of my study of Lenin or latest scholarship, which I think has put Lenin and the Bolsheviks on their feet as opposed to turn them onto their heads. So this version that you've got to begin with of Lenin splits with Martov on the basis of, I'm characterising your contribution now, of a fluffy, nice, warm, embracing, you know, workers' party on the one hand, and the highly centralised professional revolutionaries that are determined on a course that ends up as a minority dictatorship, I don't find at all convincing. The fact was that in Russia, all political parties, including the cadets, would have to operate underground. And the question is, as far as I can see, what Lenin's arguing for, how do we operate effectively? If you take the split between the Mensheviks and the Bolsheviks, it begins, yes, over some clause in the membership criteria. It quite clearly, as you go on to explain, becomes a strategic difference. Is the bourgeoisie going to lead the bourgeois revolution? Or can the proletariat align with the peasantry, lead the bourgeois revolution? But this was going to be a very peculiar bourgeois revolution, for Lenin at least, in the sense that it wasn't going to put the bourgeoisie in power. Okay, I think we're agreeing at least on that. Okay, I think that what you left out of your entire account, and I've not read Martov, so I don't know whether I'm being unfair on Martov, but I don't think I'm being unfair to you in terms of what you, at least you said. And I've not read you, except maybe a letter, maybe in the Weekly Worker, I'm not sure. But what you left out is the world revolution. What you left out was Europe. That if you take this peculiar regime, this craziness that Lenin's talking about, it's not premised on, here you are, I've read Marx was wrong. Yes, Russia, backward Russia, is going to develop socialism. That's not what he's talking about. He can use various phrases... But the development of socialism in Russia is premised, in terms of any real movement, it's premised on making the revolution in Germany. And if you don't make the revolution on Germany, then you're lost. I mean, that's my take on it. You can lose earlier or you can hang on. But the regime is a regime of hanging on. You quoted then 1929, and I agree with you actually about 1929, the significance, at least I think we agree, that this represented a rupture, this represented development, it represented the, you know, crushing of the working class, or final crushing, call it whatever you will, it did represent something new. But the idea that it represented the red bourgeoisie, or red capitalism, I just find it theoretically incoherent. If you don't have commodity production, how can you have capitalism? If you don't have wage labour, how can you have capitalism? If you don't have the extraction of surplus value, how can you have capitalism? If you don't have value, how can you have capitalism? If you don't have... Well, I'm not even going to bother with the capitalist, but The basic necessities of what makes a capitalist society ain't there. It's something else. It's quite clearly it's not socialism. It's quite clearly not in transition to socialism, but it's something else. And what I disagree with you fundamentally on is the idea that what happened in 29, the abomination And even what happened even before 29, the horrendous crimes and distortions that we saw in Russia and in the Soviet Union were somehow pre-programmed in Bolshevism going back to 1903. I think that's just an absurdity. Anyway, I presume you had my 5 minutes. So
yeah,
thanks.
So, just want to correct one point. I didn't say, I don't think, that 1929... was when things went wrong. I think it was 1918. Okay. Now, you say...
I didn't want to get into it too late.
Anyway. You say that you can't describe Russia in 1929 as capitalist, but, I mean, the first person, or the person to admit or say that Russia was capitalist, or state capitalist, was Lenin himself when he introduced the new economic policy. He openly admitted that it was state capitalism. I can understand why his political successors wanted to change that and say, "Oh, it's not capitalism; it's something else." Because I mean, if you're too honest and you're running a capitalist society, and you say to the workers, "You know, we're running capitalism," when people know that capitalism can't be run in the interests of the workers, you know, it's a difficult political position to get over. But there's a nice story in Anton Siliger's book. He was a Yugoslav. Bolsheviks, supported the Bolsheviks, who fell out with them, and was sent to a labour camp in the early 30s. And in these labour camps at the time, it was before they started shooting people, you had one barracks that was anarchist, one barracks that was Mensheviks, one barracks that was dissident Bolsheviks. Anyway, he'd never met a Menshevik before. So he goes up to this Menshevik and he says, "Why do you want to restore capitalism in Russia?" And the Menshevik says, "What do you mean, restore capitalism in Russia? Capitalism has never been abolished in Russia. They've always had commodity production. They've always had wage labour. They've always had production for profit. So capitalism, you know, never was, abolished in Russia. What changed? I don't know, you say 1929. I suppose that's when Stalin finally booted out Trotsky and the Trotsky. It's a five-year plan, things like that. What difference did that make? You still had the intervention of the state, you still had the accumulation of capital, and you still had the workers who were even worse off in 1929 than they had been in 1919. So that's at one point. I don't say the break, came in 1920. I say the fact that capitalism was never abolished in Russia at any time. There was a change of political rule in 1917, but that didn't change the basic economic thing. And to turn to your first point, I mean, Martov wasn't the only person to criticise Lenin's theory put forward in What Is to Be Done. I mean, I didn't bring it with me, but perhaps I should have done. I could have brought Rosa Luxemburg, what she said. I could have brought Trotsky's Our Political Task. I mean, it was a general view of even left-wing social democrats at the time that Lenin wasn't putting forward a Marxist point of view. And in fact, what Lenin had got this idea of a party of professional revolution. I mean, I do agree with you that in Tsarist conditions you couldn't organise an open political party, but his ideas were got from the pre-Marxist or non-Marxist Russian revolutionary tradition. That was the organisational form that people like Ogarev and others, Chekhov and people, they advocated the same thing. The difference what Lenin had done was he'd taken this organisational form. They'd said we need this minority organised professional revolution to lead the peasants in a mass uprising. Lenin took the same organisational form and said, "No, we don't. We're not going to rely on the peasants. Not mainly on the peasants. We're going to rely on the workers." And it was quite alien to the Marxist social democratic tradition. You can see why people like, and not just Marx, but I'll say it again, Rosa Luxemburg and Trotsky and others also criticise this as an aberration. Yeah. Sorry.
Michael Mayer, CPG. I think two things. One, Lars Lee's work on What Is to Be Done and early Bolshevism and on the debates of 1904, which Lenin, in fact, is quite explicit about in his reply to Luxembourg. He says, "All I'm trying to do is to adapt to the conditions of clandestinity, the organisational methods of the German Socialist Party." Yeah? And that becomes visible in 1905 when they get into legality, and instantaneously Lenin is arguing for the broadest possible opening up of the party committees, of the organisation of workers' organisations, so on and so forth. And in fact, of course, then the Bolsheviks and Mensheviks reunify in 1906, and they adopt unanimously the celebrated formula on membership, that you're a member of a party if you actually pay your dues and participate in party work, you know, in a party, pay your dues and participate in a party organisation. They adopt that unanimously because the Mensheviks have never implemented Martov's formula. They've implemented Lenin's formula in the first place, because it's the Martov formula that a person is a member of the party who gives the party some financial support and acts in some way which is could be considered to be directed by the party is totally unworkable from the point of view of party democracy, because you can't tell who's a member and who isn't a member. It was Martov's formula was intended as an adaptation to the conditions of clandestinity. So then step one is that there's really no sign of the minority the minority dictatorship line does come up in Bolshevism. Yeah, but it comes up in Bolshevism in the years 1918, 1919, 1920. The reason why it comes up in Bolshevism in the years 1918, 1919, 1920 is extremely, very clearly visible, because although the government which took power in October-November 1917 was initially a pure Bolshevik government, very rapidly it was a government, it was in reality a coalition of the Bolsheviks and the left SRs. Martov had the opportunity, in fact, to be a part of the Martov's Menshevik internationalists had the opportunity to be a part of this government, but they refused to participate in government unless the Menshevik defensists would also participate in the government. And the Menshevik defensists refused to participate in the government unless the cadets and the generals were allowed to participate in the government. They wanted a military commander. So in those political circumstances, then there is a coalition government, but in spring 1918, the Bolsheviks sign up to the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk. There is a majority in the country for the dissolution of the Constituent Assembly, but there is no majority in the country, absolutely nothing in the nature of majority in the country, for signing up to the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk. Once the Bolsheviks have signed up to the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk, it breaks the coalition, which is giving them a majority, and forces them to assert a doctrine of minority dictatorship. And because it forces them, then you get, as a result of that, in Lenin's writings in 1918, 1919, 1920, this doctrine that parties are necessary, that the classes are necessarily represented by parties which are conscious minority, and so on and so forth. That doctrine arises out of the fact that the signing the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk destroyed the majority, which created the revolution in 9th October, was a majority revolution. The dissolution of the Constituent Assembly was the act of a majority against an unrepresented representative elected body. But what the Bolsheviks did after June 1918 was minority dictatorship. I think that that's, I mean, at John's point, I agree with, that the reality is the way Martov argues assumes that capitalism is a phenomenon which develops in a single country, and that you will get capitalist development in an individual country and the conditions for revolution arising in an individual country. And that is also the way in which Kautsky argues. It's also actually the way Lenin argues all the way down to, for practical purposes, all the way down to 1970. He's plainly wrong. Because it's plainly the case that capitalism is an international social formation which organises production on an international scale. And that revolution, you cannot assess conditions for revolution in a single country, you have to assess them on the level of a continent. Okay, they gambled and they lost. And they gambled and they lost in the same way as suppose that people in Manchester were to believe that there was a majority in all of Britain in favour of socialist revolution, and they launched an insurrection. And it turns out that the people who they were relying on in southern England don't support the revolution. Then they find themselves completely in the shit. And they find themselves completely in the shit, and then they try and make the best of it. Whether the right thing to do was to try and make the best of it, or to go down in flames like the Paris Commune, is an open question. But it's worthwhile remembering Marx's comments on the Paris Commune. In correspondence, he was opposed to the attempt in the first place, but once they attempted it, he defended them publicly. And then when somebody wrote in and said why, he says, history would be very simple if you had straightforward, simple, it was transparent, it was clear, it would be no problem, you could decide whether to make revolutions or not. You don't have that choice. Sometimes things fall out that you're forced to make the attempt. And I think that was the situation. Things fell out that you're forced to make the attempt. The people, the Mensheviks, who were saying Constituent Assembly, they reassembled the Constituent Assembly in Samara, and what happens? Within months, a military coup and the dictatorship of Admiral Kolchak. In reality, the Bolsheviks only came to power because of the attempted coup of Kornilov, which was organised by the British government. In the first instance, organised by the British government. So that before October 1917, the choice which faced them was a military coup or something, some form of red terror or white terror. Before October, that was the choice which faced them. And I'm not, our own ancestors in this country, at least one of my ancestors certainly, were faced with similar choices in 1641 and 1688. You have to jump one way or the other.
But, I'm not defending Bartol or the Mensheviks, but I agree. I think the Socialist Party would agree when you say that socialism isn't possible in one country. You should think in terms in world terms. And in 1917, the whole world was ripe for socialism. And Russia could have gone socialist in 1917 as long as the rest of the world had gone socialist. But I mean, Lenin says, I mean, it's in his last articles. I mean, I think it's my personal view. I would say his lost articles. Well, his last, he realized, because he says here, Napoleon, I think, wrote on s'engage puis on voit. Rendered freely, this means first engage in a serious battle and then see what happens. I mean, they did it. I mean, he was banking on a revolution, as you say, taking place in Germany. But in fact, the chapter which the translator left out of this is Martov saying, look, what you've got in Europe after the war is lots of people who've become discontented and brutalised, by the war. But these people are not socialists. They're just discontented people who are very angry. And he said, look, the conditions for a socialist revolution, even in the rest of Europe, aren't there. And I mean, that can be confirmed. I mean, by the election in England at that time, it was called the Khaki election, because all the people who supported the war were elected a Tory government. The same thing happened in France, and it's called the red blue white election. In Germany, the Social Democrats were elected, but the support for overthrowing the Kaiser and establishing some sort of democratic regime in Germany. So if Lenin really banked on being rescued by a social revolution in the West, he was wrong. Now, ironically, you mentioned the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk, which was a treaty which took Russia, or tried to take Russia, out of the First World War. I mean, that is the thing which we in the Socialist Party of Great Britain have said, that's the best thing that Lenin did. It's not saying it's the only good thing, but that was, I mean, the Bolsheviks had promised they would stop the slaughter on the Eastern Front. they tried to stop it, you know, with at that treaty. So I mean, that was a good move on the part. It didn't work. It wasn't their fault. It didn't work because the other side, you know, wanted to continue the continue the war. But I mean, I wouldn't criticise the Bolsheviks for, you know, for signing that treaty or for trying to.
It's a question of whether you're in favour of democratic. So the sovereignty of the people, of democratic majority. There was no majority in favour of.
Yeah, but the
saying, I think it was probably the right thing to do to sign the treaty, yeah. But to do so was to impose a dictatorship of minority on a majority.
I mean, Comrade Gwynne here from the Socialist Party studied the attitude of the Socialist Party during the First World War, and our position was just stop the slaughter. Peace, immediate peace at any price. I mean, that was a position that Martov took. It wasn't the position that Lenin took up, incidentally. But you know, that was the position that we in the Socialist Party took up. So we obviously welcomed any move that stopped the slaughter. Now, to come back to what is to be done. I mean, okay, maybe maybe you're right in the situation that the Bolsheviks found themselves in, having seized power as a minority. In November 1917, they brought out, you know, what is to be done, and they republished it. They translated it into all the languages, and it became that's what communist parties and meant. This was one of their key texts, and still is. And what does it say? It says that under capitalism, left to themselves, workers were only capable of developing a trade union conscience, a bit more than trade union conscience, you're like a Labour Party.
Who's that quote from? Is it from Blonky, for example? Where does that quote come from?
Lenin, actually,
paraphrasing.
Kautsky,
exactly.
So
it's not Blonky.
I didn't say Blonky.
I know, but this kind of Blonkyist conception of elitist organisation.
No, but what is being criticised is the view that left to themselves, the workers are only capable of acquiring a trade union conscience. In fact, Kautsky was wrong. What he was criticising, the programme of the Austrian Social Democratic Party, which did say more or less, out of the very conditions of capitalism, the worker struggle, socialist consciousness will emerge out of that. Okay, Kautsky did disagreed with that, but Lenin took it much further. He implied that because the workers couldn't develop on their own beyond a trade union consciousness, this had to be brought to them by some vanguard party, some elites. That wasn't Kautsky's position, but that was Lenin's position. It was certainly the position that Bolsheviks took in the 1920s. There's a good quote in Martov's pamphlet by a Swiss social democrat who describes the position of the communists or the people supported of Bolsheviks in Switzerland in 1918, and he summarises their position like this: the great mass, the workers, are in economic slavery. They cannot accomplish their own liberation. Their minds are formed by their masters. They are incapable of understanding their true interests. It is left to the knowing minority to free the mass from the tutelage of its present masters. Only after this is done will the mass understand. Scientific socialism is the truth. The minority possessing the knowledge of the truth of scientific socialism has a right to impose it on the mass. Parliament is only an obstruction. It's an instrument of reaction. The bourgeois press poisons the mind of the people. It should be suppressed. Later, that is, after the social order will have been totally transformed by the socialist dictators, liberty and democracy will be reconstituted. Then the citizens will be in a position to form a real democracy. Then they will be free from economic regime which oppresses them, keeps them from manifesting their true will. Now, there's another quote from here from Radek, which isn't Karl Radek, which isn't quite as bad as that.
Who was that quote from?
That was a quote from somebody called Charles Nain. He was attracted by the Bolsheviks for a time, and he's trying to describe the sort of.
His version of Bolsheviks, yeah.
In a sense, yes, it is. But I mean, I think that was, Martov's thing, that what the Bolsheviks were doing, even if they were socialists or communists, they were pre-Marxist communists, like Blanqui. They believed that the minority, a communist, socialist-minded minority, had the right to seize power and then rule on behalf or in the name of the working class. And I mean, having got Trotsky's. What's it called? Terrorism and communism. He actually says the Communist minority has the right to deal with backward workers, and backward workers would be workers that didn't support the Bolsheviks. I mean, it started right at the start. They start shooting Tsarist officials and admirals and things like that. Then they go on to shoot the Constitutional Democrats, which was the bourgeois democratic party. Then it's the social revolutionaries. Then it's the Mensheviks. After that, it's the left wing of the Communist Party. And, it became a dictatorship of the Central Committee of the Bolshevik Party. I mean, you didn't have to wait till 1929 for that to happen. But I mean, Martov was there. I mean, he was arrested. He was virtually kicked out of Russia. Although I think, in fact, Lenin seems to have had some sort of a soft spot for Martov, which I don't want to be a psychologist, but I think that meant he thought that Martov was right, because when he was dying, he said, "Oh, that's a picture of Martov. He's dying too." So he had a picture of Martov in his study. But I mean, I think both of them understood that Russia was only ripe for capitalism, especially after the failure of the so-called German Revolution. I mean, the German Revolution was a revolution that overthrew the Kaiser, not overthrew capitalism. But Lenin did understand a bit of Marxism. I don't think Trotsky did, but Lenin did.
Just a quick question. I mean, someone was is a danger, I suppose, in these sort of discussions that this can turn into a sort of discussion about dead Marxists in a sort of Monty Python-esque sense. What are the real lessons for today? That's what I would like to get from this discussion. In terms of this sort of conversation and this polemic, in terms of where the working class is now, what are the lessons from this Martov-Lenin debate that can be useful for people today?
Well, I would say that the Vanguard Party form of organisation is not the right form of organisation, that a Vanguard Party aiming at a minority revolution will lead to a minority dictatorship. It won't abolish capitalism. It won't abolish classes. So that is the form, organisational form, to be rejected. Now, of course, to get rid of capitalism, the workers' wage and salary earners need to organise into a political party. So they need to organise to gain control of political power. But, I mean, if you reject the Vanguard Party, and I don't know whether this is a bit of a distortion of here, but if you reject an organisation of professional revolutionaries, you're in favour of a party which any Tom, Dick, or Harry can join. I mean, what is required is a genuine socialist party, but which is democratic in its internal organisation. Well, that doesn't exist yet. But I mean, that's going to be the way forward in the end. The working class has got to organise itself democratically and not follow vanguards and vanguard parties.
Yeah, my first point is procedural. Federalist Communist Party of Britain. My first point is procedural, in terms of how long are we going on with this, and what's the... Because, in terms of... It's obviously the SPGB do meeting slightly differently. I mean, it's not, you have contributions, then the speaker comes back.
Okay,
but I just,
we'll just have discussions if you
want. That's fine. I wanted to come back because really, look, I like Getz's book on Martov. It's a good read. Mm. It's 60. What is it? 68.
Yeah.
And I think the problem with all of the conclusions you're drawing in that sense, they are stuck in that kind of 60s, 70s, 80s Cold War period of an understanding of Bolshevism and Menshevism. We've gone beyond the Cold War consensus, right? We are actually looking beyond that now, and what you seem to be doing is, whereas a lot of the left that uncritically tail Bolshevism put a plus sign on some of the stuff that has happened, you tend to be just following the kind of other side of it, that puts a negative sign. And really, what my fundamental point is that how much you reiterate it was a minority dictatorship, a minority revolution, it wasn't. It was a strange kind of revolution. I agree with you in the sense that nobody in their right mind in the lead up to 1917 would go, we are going to have a revolution in Russia and introduce socialism. You talk about Martov wanting a working class majority. Okay, well, what about the peasantry in Russia, right? The fact is that 95%, maybe more, of Russian society is peasant-based. Lenin was a majoritarian.
And that's actually where, in some senses, that's another argument, but he had arguments with Trotsky about the nature of the coming revolution, in that it was absolutely essential to win over the support of the majority. So we have to see both the limits of the Russian Revolution and what they understood its limited nature, but also its scope and its world historical significance. They were all about Germany, which is not one country you actually even mention in your talk, let alone the civil war that then ensues as a result of this, right? These are things. So nobody, in terms of lessons for today, I call myself a Leninist, right? But my starting point isn't now to say, okay, what we need is the kind of organisation that was the Bolshevik Party in 1921, which is under strain, which is under siege, and they're trying to hold on desperately for the European Revolution. It's a tragic end to one of the most inspiring events we've seen. What you're trying to do is trying to say, this is all a result of vanguardism, which was codified in some obscure Blanquist way in some text Lenin wrote in 1902, and that led to his split with Martov. That is tired. It's Cold War historiography. Right? It's what the Stalinists say paradoxically. It's what the Hoover Institute people say paradoxically. But we've moved beyond that. We know that that's not the case. You're quoting Kautsky about you're quoting Lenin, sorry, on socialist consciousness from without. That is Karl Kautsky. Who is Karl Kautsky's mentor in terms of his critiques and understanding of programme, which is precisely what Kautsky is getting at here, the Heinfeld programme of Austrian social democracy. It's Engels, right? So you're trying to locate this kind of orthodoxy in pre-Marxist revolutionary times. For whatever the flaws of Karl Kautsky or Engels, there is actually a basic Marxist orthodoxy. You see that. You quote Rosa Luxemburg and all the critiques of Lenin. Lenin comes back to Rosa Luxemburg, as Mike says, and makes that explicitly clear. He wants a German SPD-type organisation in Russian conditions. And you... to keep putting across the conclusion that you're doing is completely oblivious to the insights that have been, particularly by Lars Lee, but also other. I mean, God, LeBlanc and Liebman actually have advanced a slightly better, more advanced understanding in terms of historiography. And I think that is generally the problem, because for you it's all reduced to this conception of a vanguard party, which is a party of a new type and completely different, and I think that the premise is completely flawed. And all the further you go on then in your conclusions are drawn from that, the more absurd they become, in my opinion. So, okay, why does this matter in terms of the debates there? I agree with you, there is a certain quirkiness to this. But no, yes, we need it. You know, nobody's saying here we don't need a open revolutionary party based around a programme with the right to organise factions, with the right to openly disagree, etc., etc. But in broad terms, that was the model that Lenin was actually fighting for, under specific historical conditions at a specific historical time. And to tarnish that whole experience, I think, is to fundamentally disarm us. Just one more point about Martov, who, again, I have a lot of time for in some ways. He's an interesting figure. He does have an odd relationship with Lenin. I think Lenin ensured that when he was in exile, he got the best doctors so they can keep him alive. They also made sure he got a visa so he could argue with Zinoviev in Halle, which you can read on the bookstore, by the way. It's a book I've recently... I've learned from Paul LeBlanc, you have to kind of plug your books. that's very true. But look at the people Martov was working with in Europe, the decisive field of battle for the fate of the Russian Revolution. Look at the people he was allying himself with, for whatever reason.
Hilferding, right?
The people who went in 1918, it wasn't just the SPD that came to government, remember, it was the USPD. And what were the USPD doing, the centrist, Menshevik-style allies of the Russian Mensheviks? They were sending in troops into Russia to hold back the revolutionary wave and to crush it, let alone what they did to the German working class. I know they pulled out as a result of pressure, but that is the fundamental thing. We have to get over that. We can't just say, oh, Marta, wasn't he wonderful? Didn't he have all the answers to this Blanquist conspiracy that was Bolshevism codified in 1903? That's weak history, and it's actually politically disarming today.